headlines. Anti-coup protesters again take to the streets in several cities across Myanmar to march against a deadly military crackdown. EU lifts Puigdemont immunity. And the trial of Nigeria's prominent Muslim player, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zakzaki, is adjourned to March 31st after resuming at the Kaduna State High Court. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Anti-coup demonstrators have once again hit the streets across Myanmar to protest against the junta's deadly crackdown. The military used tear gas to disperse the protesters. No casualties were reported during the latest rallies. Myanmar's junta took power on February the 1st, detained de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other civilian officials. That has ignited daily nationwide protests for more than a month now. Protesters demand civilian rule and the release of Suu Kyi. The military, however, has unleashed a crackdown that has killed 60 people so far. That's according to an advocacy group. It says that more than 1,800 have been detained. But the controversy over France's treatment of its Muslim community is deepening. French Muslims and rights organizations have complained to the European Commission about France's so-called Imam Charter, the brainchild of President Emmanuel Macron, that they say is the epitome of the country's state-sanctioned Islamophobia and an infringement on their freedoms. Hello, welcome. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The European Parliament has voted to lift the immunity of former Catalan pro-independence leader Carles Puigdemont. EU lawmakers also waived the immunity of two former cabinet ministers, Toni Comín and Clara Ponsati. The trio have been members of the European Parliament for at least a year now. They fled to Belgium in October 2017, following a Catalan independence referendum. They are wanted by Madrid for holding the vote that the Spanish government deemed as illegal. Madrid has hailed the EU Parliament's decision, saying that it shows the Catalan issue must be resolved inside of Spain. Madrid is expected to move to reactivate a European arrest warrant to bring them back to Spain for trial. But the extradition will have to be decided first by Belgium's justice system. Kusak Hedger is a correspondent joining us from Barcelona, and for an analysis we have Paolo Raffone, the Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation, joining us from Brussels. All right, first over to you, Kusak Hedri. If you can tell us about the reactions about this and whether, in your opinion, the extradition, which is, I'm guessing, is ultimately what Spain wants, is going to actually happen with the help of the EU, maybe.
The end of a chapter and the beginning of another one, but in all cases it is the beginning of the legal, of a new legal limbo here in Barcelona between the pro-independence forces and Spain in the European courts. I'm coming to you from the office of the European Parliament. You can see a bit of the European flag behind me, where the Catalan civil society is expected to meet to give a press conference in which they will express their view of this. They have said this morning that they generally feel that this was a victory against freedom of expression and the right of people to decide upon their future. They will develop that point later. Spain, as you said, has welcomed the move as a strength or as evidence of the strength of the European democratic institutions, and they say that the Catalan MEPs should be extradited back to Spain. Of course, as you also mentioned, now the problem is that the real case is going to be taking speed from now on, in the sense that it will be the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg which will have to decide upon the appeal that the defense team is planning to take now to Luxembourg. Their argument is the following. They believe that there were irregularities in the EU Parliament legal commission that ended up in yesterday's vote that was made public today. And the other argument is that the three MEPs, contrary to what Spain says, that they have that their prosecution predated their entry to the European Parliament is a non-argument. They believe that they should be treated as European parliaments because they have been voted by the Catalan people. In all cases, as I said earlier, this is going to be another legal limbo which will take years, and the certainty, at least for now, is that Carles Puigdemont, Toni Comín and Clara Ponsatí, the three MEPs, are stripped of their immunity. It doesn't mean that they lose their status as MEPs, but they have lost their immunity, and it is unlikely that we will see them anytime soon back to Spain, because the last word would be in the Belgian and UK courts. They will have the last say whether they would agree to send them back to Spain, and most likely they won't. Very, very briefly, I want for evidence the fact that a Belgian court has already decreed that another refugee from Catalonia should not be extradited back to Spain, because they believe that Spain's Supreme Court is not accredited to judge them, and they fear that their presumption of innocence would be stampeded or would be trampled if they were to be sent back to Madrid. Kevin.
Okay, well, let's talk to you about this, Paolo Raffone. I mean, ultimately, what are we looking at here? I'm guessing that the EU, obviously, it's in a sense not a surprise, does not want to see any word of secession, independence, etc., when it comes to the EU. But ultimately, when you take a look, and Spain, for that matter, but ultimately, when you take a look at this, the aspirations in Barcelona and around there is too high to be eliminated by this particular case that's revolving around these three officials. Is this all about setting an example here by the move that the EU has made?
Well, certainly the EU has washed its hands since the beginning, saying that it is an internal matter and it will not interfere with the Spanish judiciary proceedings and the standing of the Spanish state kingdom in handling its territorial integrity, which is the official position of the EU, but there are many critics within the EU system and especially in the parliament. And we have seen that the vote that stripped the immunity for Puigdemont and the others has seen 8 votes against and 2 abstentions, so and 15 in favor. So basically there is no unity of vision on how to handle this kind of events. The EU is trying to set, as you said, clearly a precedent to avoid any other possibility in other countries that territories may request for independence and maybe vote for it. It is very embarrassing, all this situation, for the European Union, because on one side is preaching for human rights, freedom of expression, and also democracy with a renewed offensive on democracy, and on the other side is not intervening in its own territory to establish these principles.
Okay. If I could talk to you, Kusakadri, and ask you about whether you have had any reactions there on the streets, if you had a chance to go around and see how people think about what has happened. And of course, this revives any notion of the secession aspirations, and maybe perhaps ignites for that to even be stronger.
I mean, predictably enough, public opinion here is much in line with what your guest has said, Kaveh, in the sense that everyone believes that the fact that the European Union has tried to wash its hands of the three Catalan MPs is another way of saying we don't want to get into these legal internal affairs of Europe. They insisted yesterday through a note that the ultimate decider in these kind of legal issues should be the European member states and not the European Parliament. They do not want to wet themselves or to get involved in any way possible and turn into a European tribunal rather than a parliament. That is why they're trying to throw the ball back to the member states. And of course, this is likely to ignite yet again on the social level more protest of how Spain has been handling this, because take into account that the 400 votes that voted for the lifting of the immunity are mainly from the European socialists and conservatives. And there is another factor, that, if I may really, really briefly, that showed that there is also division within the Spanish government. The socialists, led by Pedro Sanchez, have voted for the lifting of the immunity, while Podemos, which is a junior partner in the Spanish government, voted against. So those rifts are liable to reappear again as this legal limbo again takes hold in Europe and Spain and Catalonia.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's José Quedrío, correspondent there from Barcelona. And thank you, Paula Raffone, the Secretary General at the SIPI Foundation from Brussels. The trial of prominent Nigerian Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zakzaki and his wife Zinat has resumed. During the court session in the northwestern Kaduna city, prosecutors presented witnesses and new evidence against Sheikh Zakzaki. However, the judge adjourned the hearing until March 31 to allow the prosecutors to close their case. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife have been in custody since December 2015. The two are being tried for charges including homicide and disruption of public peace, which they reject. Their detention came after the Nigerian army attacked a religious ceremony in the city of Zaria, killing nearly 350 people. Since then, a crackdown has continued on Zakzaki's followers, leading to more killings and arrests. Chairman of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajare, says the trial of Sheikh Zakzaki in Nigeria is a mockery of justice.
This is not a court to implement justice. This is a court to delay justice and indeed make sure that justice is not implemented. It's almost 6 years since the incident, and no evidence has been presented even in the previous hearing. And it really is just witnesses, so-called witnesses are being brought to go on contradicting themselves from previous court hearing. And it really is embarrassing. The fact of the matter is that him and his wife is being charged for conspiracy. And up to date, over the last 6 years, around 200 people were charged for these murders, so-called murders. And the authorities have failed to actually present any evidence, first of all, to prove these murders have taken place, and secondly, anybody was involved in it. And all those 200 and all people have been freed because there's no evidence available. Now, at the 11th hour, Sheikh and his wife are being dragged for conspiracy to those murders, which already proven that there were no murders. It really is outrageous.
Iran's parliament speaker has called for utilizing women's potentials to help foster development.
In today's world, women play an effective and constructive role in the economy, that their capacities and abilities can be used to achieve development goals, especially economic ones. Women's economic empowerment is one of the important goals of development. In this regard, women can be effective in alleviation of poverty, economic growth, production, and boosting productivities while developing potential talents.
Talibov also said every country should clear the way for women's economic participation, among other areas. He said that Iran has sought to promote the status of women since the 1979 Islamic Revolution based on gender equality. He also said this approach has helped women have a more active role in society as well as politics. Okay, let's go back to our story on Myanmar and talk to Barry Grossman, international lawyer. Barry Grossman, welcome. You know, a couple of scenes that were very striking during the past week to 10 days. One, the placards that said the U.S., these are the Myanmar's people holding placards that said the U.S. should intervene. And the one that we ran today, which had on the placard R2P, which is the responsibility to protect, which is, again, a means of intervention. Which then brings about the question from you, do you think that this Myanmar issue is becoming something that may be a flashpoint between the U.S. and China if the U.S. decides to support the public protest, as it has done in many other countries?
Look, I think undoubtedly this actually started as an intentional flashpoint between the U.S. and China, bearing in mind that Myanmar, with the junta taking a backseat to Aung San Suu Kyi, decided to try this sort of limited engagement policy with the United States, which in turn is from the time Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, was moving forward with this pivot to Asia, which was really just a fancy way of talking about isolating China, in part by drawing Myanmar into its sphere of influence. And that clearly hasn't worked out very well for the country or for the junta, bearing in mind the position that was taken after the latest go-round of killings involving the Rohingya. And of course, we've all learned from that Aung San Suu Kyi isn't exactly the person that we were led to believe that she is. So now we have this happening, and there's all sorts of different interests in play here, the least of which, the least visible of which, is connected with the Rohingya and their rather desperate cause to win some form of recognition and to stop the military and others from killing them. So a lot of the people who are out in the streets condemning this coup d'etat had no problem whatsoever with violence being perpetrated against the Rohingya. And I think you'd have to be pretty naive not to expect that at the very least Atlantic World NGOs and US NGOs and probably elements from the security apparatus of the United States are involved in encouraging this response to the junta's coup d'etat, which it seeks to justify by saying, well, the election, as far as they're concerned, was hacked, and they're saying this is an interim measure, and there will be an election soon. Whether that's disingenuous or not, I guess time will tell us, but this is one grand mess. Nothing is as obvious as people would like it to be when it comes to being able to understand what's in play here. I personally would like to see China use its influence with the junta to try and find a solution for the Rohingya problem, because obviously Aung San Suu Kyi was not even remotely interested in finding a solution. In many ways, one could argue that she was even more harsh and racist than the junta itself. But this is a very complicated matter, and I would caution people to use care before jumping to any conclusions, because what we're seeing is all sorts of different people in Myanmar with an axe to grind, very often an understandable one, taking to the streets, even though they might be very opposed to having any Muslims in their country at the same time. So things don't equate as conveniently and nicely as many people out there in the social media world would like. I think we have to be patient and wait and see. I have absolutely no doubt that the United States is involved at some level in encouraging these protests, and I think it's unfortunate all the way around because innocent people, including young people, are being killed in fairly significant numbers, and that's always a tragedy. Ideally, we'll see China front up and use the considerable influence it has with Myanmar in order to encourage them to work out a solution.
Thank you very much for that, Barry Grossman, international lawyer. Many thanks for your comments. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints. همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The qualities of the people of Azerbaijan that helped create the 29th of Behman event. Another characteristic is the important role played by outstanding personalities. There are many personalities in this area who played a leading role in all the matters of the country. They are unforgettable personalities. I will tell you that we should not let this glorious history be consigned to oblivion. This history should be preserved. Undoubtedly, without a correct analysis of the history of Azerbaijan, every analysis of the history of Iran is incomplete and defective. Those who are experts and who are enthusiastic should embark on presenting a correct analysis of the issues of Azerbaijan. These were a few short points about Azerbaijan and Tabriz.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want of me. My Lord, protect me from this honor. Me faith to be stronger.
As for the 29th of Behman of 1356, after that event, Imam issued a message in which he cited three characteristics of the dear people of Tabriz. The word dear also existed in the message issued by Imam. The dear people of Azerbaijan. He mentioned three characteristics: courage, zeal, and piety. Our magnanimous Imam mentioned these three characteristics in his message to Azerbaijan. All three characteristics are really important criteria for evaluating a group of people and assessing their activities and endeavors. Courage, zeal, and piety, in the right place and right time. When the people of Tabriz staged an uprising, in my opinion, this is an important point which should receive attention. They had already seen the 19th of Day event in Qom. They have already seen how savagely the regime entered the arena to kill the people. And the regime thought that it had managed to take away the people's courage from them after the Qom incident, and that no one would dare to enter the arena.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis arrived at Baghdad International Airport on a historic visit to Iraq on Friday. Security was beefed up in Iraqi cities to welcome the Catholic leader on his first international trip since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The 84-year-old Pope called his first ever visit to Iraq the Pilgrim of Peace, saying that he was duty-bound to visit the country amid COVID-19 and security concerns. However, Iraqi officials were well prepared to welcome the pontiff as they beefed up security and imposed a nationwide curfew prior to his visit. Upon arrival, the Pope was welcomed by the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kademi in Baghdad Airport. Then he met with Iraqi President Barham Saleh at the Presidential Palace. Pope Francis called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance and said that Iraqis of all religions deserve to have the same rights.
Over the past several decades, Iraq has suffered the disastrous effects of wars, the scourge of terrorism, and sectarian conflicts often grounded in a fundamentalism incapable of accepting the peaceful coexistence of different ethnic and religious groups, different ideas and cultures. All this has brought in its wake death, destruction, and ruin.
Pope Francis entered the holy city of Najaf to hold a historic meeting with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, on Saturday. That marked the first time that a pope has met with such a senior Shia cleric. During the meeting, Ayatollah Sistani affirmed his concern that Iraqi Christians should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security and with their full constitutional rights. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani also said many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockade. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties to conflicts, particularly the world powers, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. He noted that the leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interests. That is why Pope Francis thanked Ayatollah Sistani for raising his voice in defense of the weakest and most persecuted during some of the most violent moments in Iraq's contemporary history. The Pope's visit to Ur was another highlight of his trip. The city is where the prophet Abraham, a key figure in the Christian faith, is believed to have been born. Later, the Pope addressed the faithful at the Our Lady of Salvation Church in Baghdad's commercial Qurrata district, where back in 2010, Daesh terrorists stormed the church and killed 44 worshippers, two priests, and several security force personnel in one of the deadliest attacks on Iraq's Christians.
Well, the Pope is a man of peace, and there is a great potentiality for peace. There is a great potentiality that his visit in cooperation with Ayatollah Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, might actually contribute to defeating extremism.
After the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center Twin Buildings in 2001, the U.S. declared a global war on terror. That gave Washington an excuse to enter the West Asia region, beginning with Afghanistan. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. Interestingly, during the 2016 presidential campaigns, former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. The terrorist group was vanquished in December 2017 after a three-year anti-terror military campaign with the crucial support of Iran. The top Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were key in eliminating Daesh terrorists.
And we must not underrate those. But here again, we have a great, if you like, positive emotional image of the leader of Catholic Christianity, Pope Francis, and the leader of chief figure of Shia Islam in Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, coming together, expressing what they have in common and being, in a way, friends and affirming a message of which is common to most religions. So I would say that is a very strong emotional and passionate.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, as well as wars and repression by Daesh terrorists, devastated Iraq's minority Christian community. The instability and persistent chaos resulted in a drop in the number of Christians from nearly 1.4 million to about 250,000 today. In a speech during his visit, the Pope called Iraq the cradle of civilization. He noted that the country has suffered the disastrous effects of the so-called war on terrorism. Isn't it high time for the West, especially the U.S., to stop its intervention in Iraq and put an end to its disastrous presence there?
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court, even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S. and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
And if the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased, and they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files and their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the U.N. body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations.
While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, "the essence of anti-Semitism." President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
The recent coup in Myanmar has taken the time back to 1962, when the military took control of the Southeast Asian country 14 years after its independence from Britain. Since then, the stage was set for military's power play until 2011, when Myanmar underwent democratic reforms and began parliamentary elections. The military junta seized power on February 1 and declared a one-year-long state of emergency after detaining the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy Party, among other elected government officials. The military claimed that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. However, the Election Commission nullified this claim, stating that there was no evidence. While the ousted leader is under house arrest, military commander-in-chief Ming Aung Hlaing has taken power. Despite public opposition, he attempted to justify the takeover by saying the military is on the people's side and would form a true and disciplined democracy. That is while the military junta says it wants to hold a free and fair election once the state of emergency is over. However, the country has lapsed into chaos since February 1 coup, sparking daily mass protests as well as global condemnation. The U.S. and the European Union are weighing up imposing sanctions against the junta leaders. The U.S. already has imposed some sanctions against some of the major junta leaders. Nonetheless, the military has ignored the international outcry and responded to the public opposition with escalating force. So far, 50 people have been killed and hundreds arrested during the military junta's lethal crackdown on nationwide anti-coup protests. Wednesday marked Myanmar's bloodiest day since the military takeover. The U.N. Special Envoy on Myanmar confirmed that 38 people lost their lives after security forces opened fire on protesters, demanding the return of civilian rule in the country.
Well, I guess nobody knows why, but my speculation is that they are the ones who hold on to the power at this moment, and they are very motivated by having the power, whether economically or running the country. So now, because they are taking over the country by force and nobody wants to have the military run the country, and therefore people are standing up for their rights, and that is exactly what the dictators, the Burmese government junta, doesn't want it.
Since the deadly military crackdown on the Rohingya Muslims in 2017, Aung San Suu Kyi's government has faced international condemnations. Following that, the West's interest in Myanmar has faded, and now with the military coup and the bloody crackdown on demonstrators, Myanmar is further alienating itself from the West. Moreover, as a Southeast Asian country is currently grappling with the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic and the military coup on its economy, the U.S. and the European Union are considering imposing sanctions. That could worsen the current crisis in Myanmar and push it into an ally's corner, namely China. The U.S. has already placed sanctions on Myanmar and has condemned the junta leader's harsh crackdown on the protesters. Moreover, the EU has also come out and condemned Myanmar's military, suspending development funds for the country. Yet what is interesting is how the Southeast Asian nations have so far rebuffed U.S. sanctions, which, in their words, has given the generals a lifeline.
The most important thing that we also need to understand is that Burma is one of the countries where China invests most. So, for example, we're talking about the projects that are linked to the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, which is part of the Beijing Big Belt Road Initiative that looped together a series of strategic ports, railways, and pipelines across the globe.
No Asian country has come out supporting the sanctions and anti-Myanmar actions. In this instance, China can therefore benefit economically from Myanmar, as trade with the West is now restricted.
The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region. Biden came into office amid rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq and growing calls on Washington to pull out all American forces from Iraq. Biden's team is now faced with growing attacks on American and U.S.-led foreign forces there. Does the problem have a military solution? Despite Biden's promises of change, the White House must still be thinking that it does. Because last week, Biden ordered airstrikes on anti-Daesh resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border in what his team described as a retaliation for earlier rocket attacks against American and U.S.-led forces. The U.S. airstrikes drew condemnation from resistance fighters and pledges of retaliation. On Wednesday, a barrage of rockets was fired at the Ain al-Assad Air Base, housing American troops in Iraq's western Anbar province. Advanced air defense systems at the Ain al-Assad Air Base failed to intercept the incoming rockets. Some observers believe the aerial bombardment ordered by Biden has backfired and has made U.S. forces in the region less safe.
It backfired because it was despicable and this was seen throughout the region. Everyone sees that America's just dumping its garbage on other people's heads. So it's very bad for the whole region, if in America's terms, because it increases anti-American sentiment everywhere.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. Anti-Americanism in Iraq was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attack on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces.
The Iraqi parliamentarians almost unanimously voted to expel all U.S. troops, period. And, of course, nothing has been done on that. So if a year ago the sentiment was like that, then it's only increasing. America is the enemy. America doesn't seem to get it through its head how it's perceived in Iraq and Afghanistan, wherever in the world.
But America is still refusing to heed to that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safe, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Trump withdrew several hundreds of U.S. troops from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there, despite his pledge to end American military presence in the region. How will Biden deal with the situation now? Observers believe by ordering the recent aerial bombardment on the Iraqi-Syrian border, he definitely had a bad start. If Biden stays on the same dangerous course, he risks further destabilizing Iraq and broader clashes with resistance groups.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Leadership from the perspective of Imam Khomeini. Allah, who had given authorities to the Prophet and the infallible Imams, like mobilizing and calling up the armed forces, assigning ruler and mayors, collecting taxes and spending them on the basis of Muslims' common interest, had given the same authorities to this very government with only one difference, that he did not recognize a certain person for such a post, but gave a general title for it, which is the Just Islamic Jurist.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We have another saying of Imam Khomeini, in which Imam Khomeini has said that Islam has a thesis and program for this man, who is everything, that is, has stations from the nature to the supernatural and the world of divinity. Now, in this saying, Imam Khomeini is talking about the different phases, and he's talking about the program that Islam has brought. It has brought a program which starts from the nature, which is the very basic thing. Obviously, we all mankind are made of clay. We know that we are living in a natural world, which is made of, obviously, mud and water. There are trees, there are mountains, all these natural things are there. So we are living in a natural world, which is known as Earth. Now, Islam has come to take us from this natural place, from this nature, towards the supernatural place. And after that, towards the divinity. Obviously, we need to raise ourselves. There is a difference between the animals and human beings. Usually, in the books of logics, when they define man, they define him as a haywanun natiqa, a speaking animal, or a logical animal, like who have logics, who have intellect, an animal that has intellect. So basically, for sure, we know that when a human being is defined, he's known as an animal, number one. Number two, on top of being an animal who's living on this earth, he has intellect. He can talk, he can communicate with others in different ways, he can calculate things, and he can obviously create or invent different things. That are the, we can say, like the advantages of this man over here. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. So Islam has come to take him from here to the upper level, which goes to the supernatural, and after that towards the divinity, the world of divinity, where he has to go. Obviously, his soul, his spirit, his soul belongs to that divinity. And obviously, we also have a verse in chapter 3, verse 26, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُبَيِّنَ لَكُمْ وَيَهْدِيَكُمْ سُنَنَ الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ وَيَتُوبَ عَلَيْكُمْ وَاللَّهُ عَلِيمٌ حَكِيمٌ. And Allah would explain to you and guide you by the examples of those who were before you, and would turn to you in mercy. Allah is all wise. So he will tell you how the people before you were living. This is what Quran says. They were living in the natural world. And if they were not trying to go towards the other, towards the perfection, how you can go? He will turn towards you with the mercy. How he will tell you? He will tell you by sending a school, by sending the teachers, by introducing a school. And that school that has this program to take you towards perfection, that is Islam. And that's what Imam Khomeini is also referring to. When Imam Khomeini is talking about the Islam being a program for the man, for this man, that's what he's referring to. He is saying, remember that in the Quran, these stages are said in the Quran. So if you want to go towards the perfection, if you want to achieve perfection or become purified, you must follow Islam and Quran, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, night and every day. Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and development, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war when considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war. One of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 2.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. In the first two episodes, we will take a stab at the first question, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? This episode deals with the wars between Israel and the Arabs, especially the battle that the Arabs started with a surprise attack. This is a story of two wars in the last century, one in 1948 and the other in 1973, an account unheard of from officers of the classic Arab armies. This story is based on investigations by the military research branch of the Islamic Resistance. The images take on a different personality when the founder of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, and his guardian, Ariel Sharon, join each other. These are very rare pictures of Sharon welcoming Ben-Gurion during his visit to the strongest line of fortifications in modern history, the Bar-Lev Line. It is a chain of Israeli fortifications built along the eastern coasts of the Suez Canal. The Bar-Lev Line was a massive, continuous sand wall that varied in height from 20 to 22 meters and spanned the entire 170-kilometer length of the canal. It was built 12 kilometers into the Sinai Peninsula and was inclined at an angle of 45 degrees. Then, Israel launched a massive propaganda campaign on the impenetrability of the wall and its superiority over France's World War II Maginot Line. Israel claimed the fortifications could destroy the Egyptian army in case they decided to pass the Suez Canal because the Bar-Lev Line was equipped with an underwater pipe system to pump flammable napalm into the canal and create a sheet of fire. But they were shocked when Egyptian special forces decided to pass the canal by blocking the pipe system. That was the beginning of one of the biggest military operations in modern history. In autumn 1973, every single Arab officer and soldier was on the battlefield.